tres, cuatro.
From WBEZ Chicago and PRX, this is Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. This week, the Chicago Blues. We'll talk with the founder of the Chicago-based blues label, Alligator Records, as it approaches its 50th anniversary. A half century in, he says the music hasn't lost its appeal.
I still like records that sound like you're 20 feet from the band and you're in a place that holds 100 people and there's a hard brick wall right behind the band and another wall on the other side bouncing with the sound around.
We'll also talk with and hear a live performance from the legendary Buddy Guy. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and today we're dedicating the show to the Chicago Blues. Muddy Waters brought the blues from Mississippi to Chicago in the 40s. And ever since, it has been an epicenter of that sound around the world. A little later, we're also going to revisit an interview we did with Buddy Guy, the iconic blues singer and guitarist. But first, the legacy of Alligator Records. Alligator Records is a Chicago blues label that's been around for almost 50 years. And while not necessarily a household name, Alligator Records has captured some of the most potent blues artists Chicago has offered since 1970, and has always championed a very raw and unvarnished sound, not unlike punk rock in a way. In 1970, 23-year-old Bruce Iglauer came to Chicago to work for the jazz and blues label Delmark Records, but quickly decided to stake out on his own. At a time when the blues was waning in popularity and prominence, Iglauer recognized that there was still an audience for blues among young rock fans who are interested in expanding their musical tastes. So this young white guy assembles a roster of some of the most iconic artists of the genre, and we're talking about people like Albert Collins and Coco Taylor, and got people excited about the music again. In his recent book, Bitten by the Blues, The Alligator Record Story, Bruce Iglauer, along with co-writer Patrick A. Roberts, tells the story of the evolution of Alligator, its landmark artists, and its importance in music history. Bruce, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Thanks. I've been listening for years.
1971, Chicago. Blues scene is historic already. Chess Records, VJ. You enter the scene as a label head. What was the scene like at that point? What was your impetus for forming this blues label at that point?
The blues scene in Chicago was all on the south side and the west side, which means for non-Chicagoans, in black neighborhoods. It was black musicians performing for black audiences, mostly in neighborhood clubs, in bars. There were, on a weekend, 40 or 50 places where you could go on the south side or the west side and hear great blues. I could sit 20 feet from Howlin' Wolf or Muddy Waters and just be overwhelmed by this music. And yet, so little of it was getting recorded.
Still, even after the heyday of Chess, I mean, the electric blues revival happens in the mid-50s through the early 60s. But by this point, nobody cared, 70?
Well, there were very few recording entities in Chicago or anywhere recording blues. Mm-hmm. You know, blues had been a popular music on black radio and amongst black listeners, but by the time I got here in 1970, it was an old form of music. You know, younger black people were listening to soul and various kinds of R&B and vocal groups and, you know, even the beginnings of hip-hop. Older black people still liked blues, but they weren't getting their music played on the radio.
What drew you, young white kid, to this music?
I first heard blues live in 1966. I heard a guy named Mississippi Fred McDowell from Como, Mississippi, with a steel slide on his finger playing at a folk festival. And the music just seemed so direct and so honest and so unvarnished. It was like he reached out across the rows of seats and just slapped me and said, wake up, this is for you.
You got to move. You got to move. You got to lose, but when I'm old, yeah,
after that, I just immersed myself in blues. It's music that comes from a reality. It's created between the listener and the performer. It's not music that you sit in your bedroom and work out with your synthesizer track. It's got to have an emotional effect on the audience. And for me, it's a healing effect. It makes me feel better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think people miss that, the cathartic power of the blues.
I like to think of it as you're like the wet sponge, and the blues is just wringing you out and squeezing all that bad stuff out of you.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Afterwards, the squeeze can hurt, but afterwards you feel great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of crazy, though, to start a label for an art form that, as you said, wasn't like all over the charts and a big moneymaker. I mean, there had been some blues crossover hits, a B.B. King, you know, The Thrill Is Gone, let's mm-hmm. say, but it was rare for people to make great gobs of Rolling Stones-like money putting out blues records. So why did you jump in and do that?
It was all about love of the music. In 1970, I went to a club on the South Side called Florence's Lounge that had music only on Sunday afternoons. And I heard a magical band called Hound Dog Taylor and the House Rockers. Mm. Three guys, two guitars, two electric guitars, very loud, very distorted, and a drum set, no bass.
Yeah.
Playing the rawest blues that I had ever heard and the most danceable blues that I had ever heard. I can't dance at all. I could dance to Hound Dog Taylor. So I fell in love with the band. I went back to my boss at Delmark Records, Bob Kester, great hero of American music, and I said, you've got to come hear this band. They're wonderful. They have telepathy. They make you so happy. This is the happiest blues band in Chicago. Well, he'd seen Hound Dog sitting in, and sitting in Hound Dog was kind of a disaster because other musicians couldn't follow him.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't lure him down to Florence's Lounge, and I thought, this band has got to get recorded. I've tried to convince my boss and my mentor and my father figure to record them. It's not going to happen. I'm going to do it myself.
Mm. Yeah.
So I started a label to record my favorite band, and 48 years later, I have a label to record my favorite bands.
Yeah. So Give Me My Wig, one of the first records, the first record you put out by Hound Dog Taylor.
Give Me Back My Wig.
Give Me Back My Wig.
Is one of the tracks on the album that was just called Hound Dog Taylor and the House
mm-hmm,
Rockers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of his signature song, and it was the one that got played on that moment of wonderful radio, progressive rock, freeform radio, in the late 60s and early 70s. That was the hit, quote-unquote, from that first Hound Dog Taylor record.
What does Hound Dog say to you when you approach him and say, I'd like to put out a record? Does he think like you got two heads?
He had seen me at about 100 gigs.
There's a sucker. Okay.
You stood out because you were the white guy in the audience. Right?
And well, very often I was the white guy in the audience or one of one or two. Although I got to say, I was treated very well by all the other people in the audience who realized they had come down to hear the music and I wasn't a cop.
Mm-hmm.
And Hound Dog had recorded 245s many years before. That was his entire recorded history. Nobody was approaching him about recording. And he knew there was some kind of a younger white audience, college-age audience out there for blues because Muddy Waters was playing for mm-hmm. them. And when I stood on the steps of Pepper's Lounge and I said, Hound Dog, I'd like to make an album with you. And without saying anything about what's the money or what kind of royalty rate, he said, I'm with you, baby. I'm with you.
Cool. So this man is in his 50s at this point. This artist had been around for a number of years, but it was remarkable, as you said. You listen to that record, and it just jumps out at you. And I love the interplay between Hound Dog and the second guitarist, Brewer Phillips, right? Incredible. The telepathy we're talking about seemed to be the key to that band.
And the drummer was an equal player in the band. Uh, they had played together for years. The music, you know, Hound Dog had honed his music playing for tips on Maxwell Street in the market and playing down south before he moved to Chicago, like so many Alligator artists. So they knew exactly how to play with each other. I couldn't afford multi-track recording. We recorded that record directly to two-track. We mixed it as we went. What it sounded like was going to be exactly what it sounded like when the record was manufactured. Everything was performed live in the studio with the same raggedy amps and cheap guitars that those guys used in their clubs. And the amps turned up all the way for maximum distortion because that's the way they played. Yeah. I said, sound like you do at Florence's. And that was their job and they knew it. And they just played each song a couple times and we picked the best takes and that was the record.
What was interesting about your label at that point was I think blues was sort of trending in the opposite direction in many ways because you're starting, you know, B.B. King was recording with strings and there was a little more orchestration going on. And then your records come out and they do sound like they were, you know, a step away from being in that inside that club. You wanted to get that raw feeling in those recordings.
Absolutely, and I still try for that. I still like records that sound like you're 20 feet from the band and you're in a place that holds 100 people and there's a hard brick wall right behind the band and another wall on the other side bouncing with the sound around. And I try to make records that just sound clear and so you can hear everything that's going on, including every bit of distortion, if that's what the artist plays with. To me, the studio should be not very much noticed in the recording. You know, I love things like, you know, like Sgt. Pepper, where they use the studio brilliantly. But that's not what I do, and that's not what Alligator does. The music is central, and the music should be as close to the way it's performed live, condensed, as possible.
So 300 records and half a century of history, Bruce. It's a complicated story to tell. Your book, Bitten by the Blues, does it really well. But what we thought we would do is take you through some key tracks. And you wanted to talk next about Coco Taylor. You know, I teach a class at Columbia for 300 freshmen. It's an introduction to Chicago via music. We do the blues, of course. And they are bored, right? They, you know, the blues. And then I play them. You know, Wang Dang Doodle. And then they're like, wow! Okay, suddenly they understand. What was Coco Taylor like when you worked with her?
Well, I met Coco in about 1972. She had had that hit, Wang Dang Doodle, on Chess Records, which was a hit on black radio. It wasn't a crossover record at all. But by 1972, Chess Records had been sold. Leonard Chess was dead. Coco didn't have a band. She was just sitting in, and she was working days cleaning people's houses. You know, she came up from down south with a third grade education. She either sang or she worked, and she always worked. You know, she was not a lazy person. I heard her, and she had such power. You know, this raw, gravelly sound. It just came from so deep inside her. And then as I got to know her, I discovered that underneath that, there was a kind of a shy, soft-spoken person, very direct, very, in the best sense of the word, country, you know, not varnished at all, not trying to be slick. As I got to know her and heard her sing other things, I discovered there was also a layer of subtlety in what she could do. And it wasn't just this roaring voice all the time.
You have someone new, but I'm still in love with you. That's why I'm
she could always deliver on stage. And I thought, if I can capture that essence in the studio. Coco's first album for Alligator was done in 75. and called I Got What It Takes, and it kind of bombed. It didn't go anywhere. Mm. The blues audience liked guitar players and harmonica players and guys, and Coco was a singer. She didn't play an instrument, and this was hard for the rock and roll audience that I was reaching to relate to.
Yeah!
But in 1978, we recorded her second album for Alligator called The Earthshaker. And for that album, she wrote a song that was to be an anthem for blues-loving women and blues women performers, which was an answer song to I'm a Man and Mannish Boy. Yeah. I'm a Man by Bo Diddley and Mannish Boy by Muddy Waters, called, obviously, I'm a Woman. I had suggested this idea to her, and she called me up and said, come down to my house. She lived on the South Side. She had a bungalow with her husband and her daughter, and she sang this song for me, and I thought, this is exactly what I wanted. This is a song by a strong woman, by a tough woman, by a confident woman, by somebody who's not a pushover, not a Cupid doll in front of the band.
Yeah.
And it did, it worked. It became an anthem for her, and then other women started performing it. So I'm very proud of that song because it gave her a level of confidence in herself as a songwriter and because it's become an iconic song.
When I was a little girl, only 12 years old, I couldn't do nothing to save my doggone soul. Told me the day I was grown, she said, sing the blues, child, sang it from now on. I'm a woman, oh yeah, I'm a woman, I'm a ball of fire. I'm a woman.
That album is it considered a classic by many people now, and it is sort of an emancipatory record from a female perspective. It's a distinctly female perspective. You can have my husband, you know, that song, you know. I'm a woman. These are strong, potent songs of a female expressing her individuality. One of your other big signings, and I think to your credit, Bruce, not only developing new stuff, but taking artists who had either been forgotten or who had started and their careers somehow stalled. A great example of that is Albert Collins, an artist that you signed, and he had a renaissance when he came to Alligator.
Every day, baby, when the sun go down, I get with my friends and I begin to clown. I don't care what the people are thinking. I ain't drunk. I'm just drinking.
And you did a record with him, kind of an all-star record in the mid-'80s, right?
Right. Albert became the biggest artist on Alligator for a long time, and he wasn't a Chicago artist. He was born in Texas and lived at that time in California. In the mid-1980s, I put Albert together in the studio, and I should give credit to my co-producer, Dick Sherman, who had actually brought Albert to the label in the 70s. Albert wanted to record with his great friend, Johnny Clyde Copeland, the Texas Twister, a wonderful blues man with a huge gravelly voice, and his protege from the Pacific Northwest, the then almost unknown Robert Cray. When Albert's career wasn't going well in the 70s, he would go to different cities to perform by himself, and he would hire a local band to be his backing band. And when he went to the Pacific Northwest, it was the young Robert Cray band. And Robert and Albert just bonded. It was a father and son relationship. We put these guys together in the studio, and in 3.5 days, we recorded a record that has stood as a classic Chicago and world blues record called Showdown, where they took each other on in a very friendly competition. All we had to do was get these three guys together with a great rhythm section in the studio and get out of the way.
I feel my love coming down. You see,
but they just don't know how I feel inside. I said, all my friends call me crazy. They just don't know how I feel inside. You see, I love this little girl. Of course, she got the little pretty brown.
When we return, more with Bruce Iglauer, Alligator Records founder and author of Bitten by the Blues. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot here with my partner, Jim DeRogatis, and today we're exploring the history of the Chicago blues label Alligator Records. We're talking with label founder and author of the new book, Bitten by the Blues, Bruce Iglauer. Now, we've been highlighting some of the most significant artists on the label. Let's talk about some of the artists who are still making records today. Now, I know, Bruce, you want to talk about Taranzo Cannon, the guitarist, singer, and songwriter. What's so special about Taranzo?
Taranzo is a veteran Chicago blues musician who began as a sideman and has his secret identity as a full-time Chicago Transit Authority bus driver.
Oh, man. No wonder he's got to play the blues.
Well, oh, absolutely.
There's a lot of stories on a CTA bus every day, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, there are a lot of aggravation, too.
Oh, he's told me that he's taken knives off of people and that he's, you know, thrown people off the bus.
Yeah.
And he would play three nights, four nights a week. Sometimes he'd play till 4 a.m. He'd be driving the bus at 7 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
I watched him develop from kind of a regular sideman playing and then starting his own band and playing familiar songs. And then he began writing. And he did two records for the Delmark label where I used to work. And I saw his growth as a writer. We got to know each other. And I saw there was potential, even in his 40s, for this guy to make a giant step as a performing artist. We spent a year while he honed his songs for the Chicago Way album. We would get together at my house, actually, one night a week, and sometimes he would write two words or three words or one line. But over a period of time, they became more and more personal and more original and interesting. Plus, he's got this great sense of humor. He's a really smart guy and a really funny guy.
Mm-hmm.
So for the track that I chose for this show, I chose a song about a guy getting a divorce.
Bad contract.
Yeah. He said, my wife's stabbing me in the back with a lawyer's knife. and he played his butt off on this record and sang it because he knows lots and lots of people who have been divorced and have been through that.
Check it out. Read about it, heard about it. Now it's me. Should have seen it coming, would have stayed free. Big fancy wedding for her friend's jealousy. The house was mine.
Interesting what he writes about. You talk about the subject matter. I interviewed him a year and a half, 2 years ago. We talked about this whole notion of who's your audience, who you're writing for, what are you writing about. And it was very adult themes, you know, and not in a sort of, oh, they're so explicit. It's more about these people have been around the block. They've experienced life to a degree that maybe a teenager hasn't. Which is interesting because I don't think a lot of people in the modern day music industry really talk about the existence of that audience that is still interested in new music, quote unquote, but is more written about and for them.
Blues is generally adult music and has adult themes and deals with the realities of the world. It's not very sentimental. There are blues love songs, but there are many more blues relationship falling apart songs. Mm. I look at artists like Taranzo, and I see their audiences, and their audiences look a lot like me. Their audiences are, you know, middle-aged, growing a little stomach, losing a little hair. And those people are very much moved by this music.
Let's talk more about another current Alligator artist, Shamika Copeland. She's 39 years old, and she's one of the younger blues artists on the map. Now, she had a fascinating 2018 album called America's Child that I think really moves the genre forward and doesn't feel like the old blues of the 40s. It's a very contemporary sounding record. Would you take my blood? Would you take my blood? Or would you rather die than share your life with mine? Would you take my blood? Would you take my blood? I'm reaching out to you. Would you take my blood? As far as I'm concerned, blues cannot reproduce what's already been done. First of all, you're not going to do it better. You know, if you do a Muddy Waters song or a B.B. King song or songs in that style, they're not going to be as good as the originals. Mm-hmm. So just like every other form of music, blues has to adapt to its current world and its current audience. My joke with the musicians is, you know, I want you to, instead of singing, you know, woke up this morning and I got behind my mule and plowed, woke up this morning and my hard drive crashed. iPhone is on the fritz.
Yeah. You know? Shamika sings about more important stuff than that.
Right.
I got what you mean. Yeah, in terms of the mindset, don't be stuck in the past.
Right. So Shamika, who started as very much a straight blues and kind of traditional R&B singer, and by the way, is the daughter of Johnny Copeland, who was on that Showdown
musical
album.
Musical royalty.
I signed Shamika, and I'm so proud of this. I signed Shamika right after she turned 18. I saw her when she was 17, and she was a killer already. We made her first album right after her 18th birthday, and it still stands as a very strong but more traditional record.
I love that record.
Mm-hmm.
More recently, Shamika has been reaching out into the Americana side of music, which is very much a song-centered music, much more so than the flashy guitar solo or the screaming vocal. And she's performing songs, especially on this new album, America's Child, which I didn't produce. It was produced by Will Kimbrough, who's part of the Americana scene. But I'm very proud to have released it because of the statements it makes. Mm-hmm. And Shamika's a recent mom. Mm. She had little Johnny just 2 years ago. And it's kind of changed her view of things because she's thinking more about the future and what the world should be and could be. And the first song is a statement that we can all rally behind, which is "Ain't Got Time for Hate."
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're living in a very strange period in American and human history.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to be noticing what we have in common instead of what we don't have in common. And she's all for that. And I'm so excited and proud to have this on Alligator because I love the statements and because the music is so good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are catchy songs performed with the thing that all Alligator records are supposed to have, passion.
Where's your wings, little angel? Smart, you better be strong. Ain't gonna be here long. I don't care if you're rich, never had a dime. This whole life is an uphill climb, and I ain't got time, ain't got time, ain't got time for hate. One more moment is a moment too late.
I want people who are not afraid to lay all their emotions out there, you know, in the recordings. You know, don't hold back. There is nothing cool. We are not a label of cool music. We're a label of hot music.
Mm-hmm. Let's say 20-year-old Bruce comes along in 2019 and says, you know, hey, maybe I should do this. What would you tell that person?
Well, I'd tell the person to apprentice first. I'd tell the person that they better get their satisfaction in life from something other than money, because...
what is that money you speak of?
To me, money is just a tool. Money's like a shovel. If you don't do something with it, it has no value.
Mm-hmm.
I've never made much money doing this, but boy, have I had a ton of satisfaction. You know, I've had so many thrilling experiences at gigs and in the studio. That's way better than, you know, having a nice car or something.
Heck yeah.
I would tell that person to immerse himself or herself in the music, to get to know the musicians, because ultimately we are the vehicles for their expression. And, of course, to figure out how to market this stuff in a very changing business environment where even though with blues we sell still sell a lot of CDs, and we have some titles on vinyl and we sell those too, but we're moving toward a world of all streaming, and we know this. It's a battle.
Well, it's all in the book, Bitten by the Blues, The Alligator Record Story. Bruce Iglauer, thank you for coming on Sound Opinions.
Thank you for inviting me, and thanks for recognizing this wonderful music.
That wraps up our conversation on Alligator Records, and now we want to hear from you. Alligator Records founder Bruce Iglauer finds that blues records work like a sponge and suck up all the bad feelings for him. What song rings you out when you're having a rough time? Tell us about it. Call 888-859-1800 and leave us a message. Coming up, we're continuing the theme of Chicago blues with Buddy Guy. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Cott, here with my partner Jim DeRogatis, and this week we're talking about the Chicago Blues. Now, before the break, we talked about Alligator Records, a Chicago-based record label that has helped to document the unique blues sounds coming out of the city for the last half century. That blues legacy doesn't start with Alligator, of course, and because one of the great blues labels out of Chicago to gain worldwide audiences was Chess Records, home to Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Coco Taylor at various points in their careers. Another artist that worked with Chess in the early days is guitar legend Buddy Guy, who started his recording career in 1959. Back in 2007, Buddy Guy joined us to talk about his one-of-a-kind guitar playing that deeply influenced rockers like Eric Clapton and Jimi Hendrix. He also performed a rare acoustic set. Today, we're going to revisit part of that interview.
You're a towering giant on the electric guitar, but one of the things about having you come to our studio and play acoustically is we can really get inside the music in a way. I love everything Buddy does, but the acoustic thing is special, isn't it, Greg?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know you've got an acoustic in your house. Are you playing the acoustic a lot when you're not at the club and you're not out in front of people a lot?
He said his kids never hear him.
Yeah.
That's a bad habit. I don't recommend this to nobody. But, you know, when I'm home, I listen to a lot of spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
So what I try to do is pick up some of the voices that I hear in spiritual music and then pick up the guitar.
So you're trying to imitate the voices with your guitar.
I learned that from B.B. King. He said, you know, when I first met him, he said he was really wanted to learn how to play the Robert Johnson, the slide, and he never could. And he the one invented bending the strings to get as closer to that as you can. And so when he came out singing and his voice and his bending the strings was so close together, you know, he was playing like his voice was singing, and I just fell in love with that.
Oh, I don't want a soul, baby, hanging around my house when I'm not at home.
Being in Baton Rouge and seeing these guys and saying, I want to play like B.B. King, but I want to act like Guitar Slim. Those were the two kind of big influences, it seemed, early on. So you've talked a little bit about B.B. King. What was it about Guitar Slim that you wanted to emulate?
Well, first of all, I didn't know what a Strat was.
Mm-hmm.
And I went up to, I think I paid 30 cents or something to see him. And they wouldn't let the BB or Guitar Slim or Smiley Lewis or Fats Domino and them come out because it was all small blues clubs. And as long as they didn't come on the stage, the club owner could sell more booze. So they would be sitting there saying, don't bring them on yet, you know, let me make a little more money. Because when they come, you stop buying booze and watch.
Mm-hmm.
So they would make the band just play. And finally they said, ladies and gentlemen, Guitar Slim. And I heard the guitar. And I'm sitting there saying, what kind of crap is this, man? I didn't pay my 35 cents to see, you know, a record.
The band.
The band and the record. I heard the guitar, but yeah. I didn't see him. And all of a sudden, this guy walks in the door, you know, like you do your little baby, put him on your shoulders, and when he's 2 or 3 years old, walking, this guy, big heavyside guy, come in with him on his shoulder, wailing his strap, man, with a red suit on and white shoes, and he dropped him on the stage, it's been his head up, and I said, wow, what is this?
That's an entrance.
Yeah, and he was real wild, and I said, now, I saw BB, and I saw you, I said, I really want to play like BB, but I want to act like you.
Absolutely. Well, you've got a guitar in your hand, and you've got Rick Hall from your band here with you as well.
Yes.
How about playing some songs for us?
Sure. Thank you. Good morning, little schoolgirl. Good morning, little schoolgirl. Can I go? Can I go home with you? Just tell your mother and your father that I'm a schoolboy too. I remember way back when I was a young 9. You know I think about my school days, and it surely do worry my mind. I'm gonna buy me an airplane. I'm gonna fly all over town. You know if I don't find my little schoolgirl, I ain't gonna let my airplane down. Just tell your mother and your father, oh girl, I'm a little Schoolboy 2.
The arrangement you just played of Good Morning Little Schoolgirl, the song has been played a million times, and you kind of hear the same kind of version of that. You've always kind of been experimenting with stuff, and at the same time, the ability for you to sort of play that way was not really appreciated at Chess Records. You said you didn't feel like you really got a chance to make the record that you wanted to make until 1979, well past the Chess years. And we had Andy Summers of The Police in here, and he says, well, I was best buddies with Eric Clapton in the 60s, and I was looking at Eric, and he was looking at me, and says, yeah, you stole it all from Buddy Guy, didn't you? And Eric Clapton's like, yeah, we did. And so, in other words, these guys were watching you in the 60s and stealing your style, this kind of explosive guitar style you had, and yet you were on a record label that wouldn't allow you to record the way you wanted to be heard.
Walking down through the woods. Yeah, the first time I met you, blue, you know I was walking down through the woods.
Did you get into arguments with the Chess Brothers saying, hey, just give me a chance, or was it a case of these guys were the last word on every subject and it wasn't worth arguing with them?
I never was the type of guy to go in and just demand. I just kept hitting those notes and they heard it and they didn't forget it. And they had hits with Muddy, Walter, Wolf, and all those things. They had been successful with that and they was like sticking to their guns. And I just was going in, like we talked here now, getting ready to play behind Muddy, Walter, Wolf, someone. I'd turn that guitar up and they would hear that and they would use a lot of profane. You know, they would tell me to get that MF out of there, man. And I didn't get angry, you know, and I just kept it here. Until I went to the clubs, and then I turned it back up, and I was doing it. And I finally went to England in February of 1965, and I was doing it. And every time I see Jeff Beck and Eric, they slept in a van and saw me do that because they said they didn't even have a Strat. They didn't think a Strat could play blues. A Strat was supposed to play this country and western until they saw me play it. And I just said, oh, man, I didn't ever think of that. I just thought it was a guitar, you know, just play, because after I saw Slim with it, that's the first Strat I ever saw. I said, man, that's all I want to do, that guitar. Because you could drop it, you know, the acoustics, if you drop them, they like to crack open. And I saw that Strat, I said, man, if you drop that, you just pick it up and keep playing it.
Was that violence that you were bringing to the electric guitar in the early, mid-60s, was that going, obviously that was going over in the clubs. People loved to hear that.
When I came to Chicago, there wasn't one blues player that would stand up and play. And I saw Slim. All of them were sitting down in chairs with music stands, whether they was reading it or not. You know, just the big thing with these big names on there. If it was Clarence Thomas, they had a CT. And I can't play as well as these guys, but I said, if I stand up and walk down this bar with this 100-foot cord that I saw get that Slim play with, somebody gonna pay attention to me. And they did. So I would jump off the bar and run out the front door, and they would say, crazy, well, what is that, you know?
Now, buddy, when you play for us, as we're lucky enough to have you do once in a while, you know, the music is alive and it's vibrant, and we're talking about lust, we're talking about hate, murder ballads, there's that striving, I want to get out of the streets and to the top, I want to own the world. That's everything that's in hip-hop, but we so rarely see the blues songs being used as the foundation for hip-hop.
You know, you don't know about my daughter, do you?
Yeah, I do, buddy. I know about Shauna making those hip-hop records, but the listeners might not, so why don't you fill them in?
Well, anyway, she is into the hip-hop, and there's more people know her now than it is me, man.
You
know?
I don't think so.
Oh, yeah, because she's been on this BET television and the VH1, and actually she got me on VH1. And She called me. She was down in Atlanta with Ludacris. She said, "Daddy, I was thinking about sampling some music, and I found out if I sample other people's music, I got to pay. But say, I think I'm going to start sampling yours, and I don't have to pay." So they called me in to play one track on it. And I beat them there that morning. I had played, I'd say, "Let me hear." And I was messing with the guitar while I was doing it.
"Hey there.
Hey.
How you? Mwah. Everything cool?
I don't know. I'm trying to see if you're going to like this.
I'm going to love it.
When they came in, her and a producer, they said, "That's it. We don't have to listen no more. Will you do another one?" And so they got me on two of her tracks.
Daddy told me this industry ain't what you think it is, and every day you will be gone, you will think of your kids. No matter what they throw at you, get your biscuit and grits, get your kibbles and bits.
Buddy, can you favor us with one more song? That would be great if you got one more in you.
Okay, all right. Can't do the things I used to do because I'm an old man. Well, I done got old. Well, I done got old. Can't do the things that I used to do because I'm an old man. Look here. I can't walk like I used to. I can't talk like I used to. I can't love like I used to, because things done changed. Oh, oh, I'm an old man. Can't do it no more. I'm a very old man, but I'm a pretty good old man. Walk like I used to. I can't talk like I used to. I can't love like I used to, because things have changed. Oh, baby, you know I'm not the same. Set up for you now. See me coming, give me a rocking chair. See me coming, give me a rocking chair. You know I ain't no stranger. I just feel like lying right down here. Sun going down, moon begin to rise. Sun going down,
moon begin to rise. You know I miss my baby, the tears coming down from my eyes.
Buddy Guy on Sound Opinions, Rick Hall backing him up there from his band. Buddy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And without you guys, I don't know, man, we need all the help we can for blues. And God bless you, man. Just keep playing it and let the people know that we're still here. And there's nothing bad about the blues. If you break it down and listen to it, we just talk about everyday life.
Yeah, you got it. Buddy Guy.
Thank you.
That was Buddy Guy speaking with us in 2007. You can hear the whole interview at our website, soundopinions.org.
Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, we're going to do a classic album dissection of the masterpiece by Iggy Pop and the Stooges, Funhouse.
Download your Sound Opinions wherever you get your podcast thingies. The show has been produced, as always, by Brendan Banasak, Alex Claiborne, Ina Contreras, and Andrew Gill.
I've been calling you what else of your fault.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So now it's time to hear what you have to say.
Your folks say you.
New messages.
Just heard the episode on weird instruments and rock music. I loved it. It made me think about Quintron, who is a magician of a musician from New Orleans and invents his own instruments, including one called the Drum Buddy, which features a rotating platter and photoreceptors and a coffee can in order to produce percussions for some of his music. Incredible machine. He's very inventive with it. It's a lot of fun. I think it's worth checking out.
Hey, this is Michael from Springfield, Oregon. Yeah, unusual instruments. My grandfather was a very gifted musician and a preacher. And one of his instruments was the ocarina. I never saw this happen, but the family lore is that my grandfather would lead the church hymn singing from the ocarina. Until I hear of a competitor, I'm prepared to call my grandfather the king of the gospel ocarina.
Come on and hold me tight.
Thanks, bye.
Hey, Greg and Jim, it's Matthew Newman. I'm calling you from Brussels, Belgium. Just wanted to talk about your songs about writers. A book that was not on your list is L'Étranger, The Stranger by Albert Camus, and the song Killing an Arab by The Cure. It's about what happens in the book. It's an existentialist examination of what happens when someone is lacking feelings and has no idea that he's just telling the truth and that will lead him to his ultimate demise is expressed really well in the song. Robert Smith, the lead singer for The Cure, had some misgivings about this particular title, and it's come back to haunt the group. People misinterpreting it, people having no idea that it has a literary reference. I think it's a perfect example of how literature and art and music sometimes can cause problems when it's misinterpreted. Keep up the great work. Thanks.
This is Lori calling from Cary, North Carolina. I enjoyed your show today on music and literature, and I wanted to share my favorite example of that intersection, which is Peter Gabriel's beautiful song, Mercy Street.
Pictures the broken glass, pictures the steam. She pictures the soul with no leak at the seams. Take the boat out, wait until darkness. Let's take the boat out.
It's inspired by the life and work of the poet Anne Sexton, and it just beautifully captures the lonely longing and sadness and regret that characterized her life and work. I enjoy your program. Thank you. Bye-bye.
No more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.